So we're continuing with this series on Joel. It's going to run for 4 weeks. We've already had 1 week. And I never realized what an influential book this book actually is. There are so many echoes of Joel, for example, through the rest of the New Testament. Again and again, they're actually quoting from different aspects of the prophecy of Joel. Now, for those of you who weren't here last Sunday, Rowan was preaching on this particular book, on the first chapter, and he made the comment that Joel really is something of an alarm. It comes to us as an alarm. And when we think of alarms, I think many of us, we think in terms of that little sound on our mobile phone, that xylophone or that falling raindrop sort of thing. If you are a little bit quirky, you have a baby crying in the background. Keith Stewart's phone does that. We think of the ding-dong of my kitchen rules, sort of things that are not too disturbing. The alarm that Joel is sounding, I think, is the very opposite. Forget about alarms on your mobile. That's what Joel is intended to be. It's intended to be something that is shocking, frightening, awful. It's something that is to cause terror in the hearts of those who hear it. Blow the trumpet in Zion. Sound the alarm on my holy hill. Let all who live in the land tremble, for the day of the Lord is coming. Now, for an agrarian economy, we can understand why the prophecy of Joel would have had that sort of effect. The locusts are coming, and there are so many of them that the sun will be darkened. They will cover every inch of the ground like a carpet. Not a blade of grass will be left standing. They'll come streaming in through the windows, through the doors, if you don't close them. With their little teeth, they will gnaw away at your vines. The fruit on your pomegranate trees and your apple trees will be cut away. Even the bark will be stripped. There will be no wine for the drinkers, no fodder for the cattle, no grain for the sheep, no offering for the altar. Wail, you drunkards. Mourn, you priests. Grieve, you farmers, because these locusts will leave nothing behind. And what happens in times of national crisis? Well, people run around madly, not knowing which way to turn. Some people turn back to God and begin to rush back to church, and they cry out to God for mercy, and they call for a national day of prayer and a day of fasting and so on. And that's something of what we see happening in Joel. The priests put on sackcloth. They pray through the night. They call for a day of fasting and mourning. They summon the leaders to a prayer meeting. It is scary stuff that we are dealing with in the book of Joel. And the point to all of these ominous signs, these predictions of gloom and doom, well, the purpose is clear: to put the fear of God into the people who are listening. And you don't want to beat around the bush about this. You cannot escape the fact that that is what Joel is seeking to do. He's seeking to frighten people into action. And that's not a very popular idea these days. We know that that's the case, that he's trying to frighten his people, the listeners, because of this recurring theme throughout the book of Joel, that this is no accident. This is not just one of those things that happens. No, this is God's doing. It's God who's making it happen. Those invading armies of locusts with their insatiable appetites, they are marching to God's drumbeat. They come at his behest. And you can see that, for example, in verse 11. The Lord thunders at the head of his army. His forces are beyond number, and mighty are those who obey his command. The day of the Lord is great. It is dreadful. Who can endure it? So clearly what Joel is wanting to do is he's wanting to engender fear and terror in the hearts of his hearers. Panic at the news of God's impending judgment. Now you need to understand that this is not just particular to Joel. This is not just unique even to the Old Testament. We find it also, that same sort of thing happening also in the New Testament. Dire warnings of judgment and calamity. For example, in Paul. So if you have a look at Apostle Paul's writings to Romans chapter 2. Because of your stubbornness and your unrepentant heart, you are storing up wrath for yourself or for the day of God's wrath, when his righteous judgment will be revealed. It's scary stuff. And also we find the same sort of thing in a number of different places, even in the words of Jesus, but also we find it here as another example in the book of Revelations. Then the kings of the earth, the princes, the generals, the rich, the mighty, and every slave and every free man hid in caves and among the rocks of the mountains. They called to the mountains and the rocks, saying, "Fall on us and hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of their wrath has come, and who can stand?" Scary, scary stuff. Now, this idea of trying to frighten people is something that is frowned upon in many circles. I remember having a discussion with our relatives, and they objected. They said, "No, you're just trying to frighten us. You're just trying to scare us." As if frightening people is the most evil, inherently immoral thing you can possibly do for people. Trying to frighten them. But those same people don't complain when they find a danger sign on the side of the road saying, "Be careful, this is a warning, there is a tight circle, a tight turn coming up ahead." Or those people who are listening to the radio and hearing dire warnings of a fire that's approaching their homes and encouraging them to take care. They don't say, "You're just trying to frighten us. You're just trying to scare us to leave our homes," do they? They don't do that. They appreciate the fact that there's been a warning. And that's exactly the point that we find with Joel and with many other places in Scripture. They're warning us. They want us to slow down, to take note. They want to cause us, through the fear of what's coming, to take evasive action, lest we feel the full force of God's judgment. That's what Joel is about. At least the first 1.5 chapters. So that's something just to understand, to know. I just wanted to make that point, that this is a dreadful alarm. It's an alarm that causes fear, terror in those who hear it. The second comment that I'd like to make about Joel is that on occasions he seems to be speaking about something that is more immediate, something that will affect him and his community in the near future. It seems to be something particularly appropriate for Joel's people, the people that he's writing for initially. But as you look more closely at it, as you inspect it more deeply, you begin to recognize that he is at the same time is speaking about things beyond this, into the future, sometimes into the very distant future, sometimes even about things at the end of the age. When I was a student at Bible College, we weren't very wealthy at that stage, and I remember feeling quite fortunate that I came into possession of this old second-hand cine camera. One of those ones that you wind up, it's got a spring-loaded thing, and you take the sort of, you know, the film for about 30 seconds, then you've got to wind it again and you continue. And I, no sound. This was before the advent of the video camera. And I asked my friend to use this little cine camera to take our wedding. When Linda and I got married, we had the cine camera, and this guy was around the back filming the whole event. What I didn't realize was that I had given him one of those cassettes. Reels that actually already had been filmed on. So it was already exposed one time through. And so throughout this, the wedding, he basically was taking these pictures of all, you know, Linda in her glory and so on. And the end result was that when we finally got to see our video, you had these sort of like superimposed pictures on top of each other. We'd filmed the whole video on top of something else that had been exposed. And so you had this, as I say, superimposition of one film and another. And so you'd say, oh, there's Linda. Isn't she looking beautiful in her sort of white gown? And how come there's somebody playing tennis in the foreground? And there's Ian looking handsome as ever, and he's waiting for his wife to come down the aisle. But now he's running in the wrong direction. And you, it's really difficult to make out what you're looking at. And it's a little bit like that with Old Testament prophecy. You have what looks like different scenes that are superimposed on top of each other. The prophet is able to speak about things that are true for his own generation, but he's also able to peer into the future at the same time and see things that are yet to be. And you can see that, and you get a sense of that, I think, from Joel when you're reading about these marching hordes of locusts. You sort of think, these are obviously locusts. But then as you go on, you suddenly realize, I don't know if it's only locusts that we're looking at here. It looks like these are the armies of men marching on Israel, carrying the people off into exile. You get a sense of that from verse 11 of chapter 2. The Lord thunders at the head of his army. His forces are beyond number. And mighty are those who obey his command. Suddenly it's no longer just the locusts we're looking at. Suddenly it seems it's something more. And this superimposing of images on top of each other, I think, is also true for the day of the Lord, this theme that occurs again and again in Joel. So on one hand, the day of the Lord seems to be something that's about to happen the next few years. It's going to hit Israel, 8th century B.C., but then as you carry on reading, you realize this day of the Lord has got a cosmic aspect to it. It seems to include the whole world. Everyone will gather before the Lord from all over, and judgment will then happen. You can see that from verses 14 to 16. Multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision, for the day of the Lord is near in the valley of decision. The sun and the moon will be darkened, and the stars no longer shine. The Lord will roar from Zion and thunder from Jerusalem. The earth and the sky will tremble. Seems to be much more than just something isolated to little physical Israel. So as you read Joel, don't just pass over it as something that's irrelevant. Don't say to yourself, oh, locusts, we've had those happen here in Australia before, and we know how to deal with them. We just spray them with some spray, fly over with some planes, drop the stuff on them, and they'll be gone. I think rather, use your imagination. Imagine something that would be truly devastating for us living in this land of ours. A drought that goes on for years and years. No water, no rain. Or the opposite, floods that make the 2011 flood seem like a drop in a bucket. Or some outbreak of anthrax and foot and mouth and mad cow disease and Ebola all at the same time. That's what Joel is wanting us to do. He's wanting us to imagine, see something absolutely awful as a picture of the judgment that is coming, as a way of frightening his readers. Not only frightening them, but frightening them into action. And you can see that from verse 12 to 13. Even now, return to me with all your heart, with fasting and weeping and mourning. Rend your heart and not your garments. Return to the Lord your God, for he is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger and abounding in love. He relents from sending calamity. Who knows? He may turn and have pity. The fear has an objective to cause us to repent, to turn, to come back, to return again to our God. There is something in these verses here that says, It's got to be more than just outward appearance sort of stuff, stuff to do with the externals. Yeah, you can go to church, and that's great. And yes, you can pray the prayers, and you can make the confessions. We have erred and strayed like lost sheep. We have done too much, and so on. You can do that. But I think what this passage is saying is it's got to be much more than that. It's got to be heartfelt. One of the ways in which the Jews used to show that they were spiritually distressed, grieved, was they used to, part of the ritual, I suppose, was they used to literally tear their garments. They would see something awful, something, they would hear some terrible news, somebody in the family had died, and just ripped their clothes as a way of saying, I am terribly upset. You would know something awful had happened. But it's possible to even do that sort of thing, rip your clothes, and yet for it all to still be just external. And what we find here in these verses is God saying, I don't just want the externals. I want you to rip your heart. I want your heart to be broken. I want to see grief coming from a brokenness inside, brokenness to our own sinfulness. That's far more important to God. At the same time, it's important to recognize that this forgiveness that we speak about, it's not automatic. It's not like God is some sort of jukebox. You press a button and you choose your song and you get your music. Not like that at all. God does not dance to our tune. He's sovereign. He's almighty. We can't demand anything from Him, not even forgiveness. That's the result of His choosing. It's His decision. And I think that's what's implied in those words. Who knows? If you turn, if you repent, if you call out to God, if you rend your hearts, He may yet have mercy. He may relent and have pity. In closing, it's interesting to notice the basis, the grounds on which we can cry out to God. We can cry out to God on the grounds of His character. And then secondly, we can cry out to God on the grounds of His reputation. On the grounds of His character, you can see that in verse 13. Return to the Lord your God, for He is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger, and abounding in love. That's what God is like. God is a God who, in terms of His character, is a God who is gracious and compassionate. And yes, He is aroused by people's sinfulness. And yes, it does make Him want to rise up and judge that sin. But it's not His first choice. He's reluctant to do so. Why? Because He's gracious and compassionate. He would much rather forgive and restore. He would much rather have mercy and show grace. And we see that most beautifully played out in the story of Jesus, don't we? We've sinned. We've done what's wrong. We've fallen short of God's standards. We've let God down again and again. And yet God, who should judge, instead sends His Son and judges Him in our place. He bears the punishment that we deserve, so that God might have mercy on us. Why? Because He's a God who's gracious and compassionate, slow to anger and abounding in love. So why should we cry out to God for mercy? Well, because we know that He's a God who's a God of enormous grace and compassion. But also because we know that He is a God who is jealous for His own reputation. And you can see that in verse 17. Lord, do not make your inheritance an object of scorn, a byword among the nations. Why should they say among the peoples, where is their God? You see, the surrounding nations all had their own gods. And when a nation actually went into decline, the other nations would say, aha, can't say much for their God. wasn't able to keep them going, to protect them. And so there's an issue for Joel in terms of his prayer that if God does not intervene on Israel's behalf, the nations are likely to interpret it in the wrong sort of way, that somehow God is weak and unable to intervene. It would be a sign of Yahweh's impotence. They would say, aha, so where is your God now? And there are parallels for us today, aren't there? When you as a Christian stumble, there will be people, even from your own family maybe, who will say, aha. So you're meant to be a Christian, are you? And this is the way you behave. I thought your God was able to change you, change your heart, give you a new life. I don't think we have enough concern for God's reputation. And our prayer to God needs to be along the lines of, Lord, come to my aid, rescue me from my sinning, because I don't want to bring disgrace on your name. I care about your reputation. For the sake of your glory, Lord, for the sake of your glory, come and save me. And at the same time, the remedy that is ours through Jesus Christ is God's greatest glory. The fact that God is able to rescue sinful men and women like us through the atoning sacrifice of Jesus is a never-ending cause of awe and wonder in heaven and a matter of ongoing praise and adoration among God's people. Praise you, God, for what you've done for us in Jesus. The mercy that you've shown to us in Jesus is too marvelous for words. It is God's great glory. Come, let's spend a moment just reflecting and meditating on this passage from Joel.